Today is Wednesday, June 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, protests and controversy as President Trump continues his trip to Europe. The U.S. threatens Mexico with tariffs if it doesn't step up on border control.
No doubt that tariffs would hurt the U.S. economy. The tariffs would be borne by U.S. consumers and U.S. manufacturers.
Also ahead, we'll tell you who is now officially the richest female musician in the world. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump deployed a mix of diplomacy and barbs in a joint news conference with British Prime Minister Theresa May in London Tuesday. VOA's Patsy Wuodukuswara reports from London on the second day of Trump's visit to Britain.
Protesters flooded the streets of London on the second day of President Donald Trump's state visit to Britain with different messages for the U.S. leader.
Because of his climate change policies and the fact he's pulled out of the Paris Agreement.
Values like respect for other people, tolerance, non-discrimination.
My biggest problem with Trump is just the hate within him and the fact that he can bring that hatred out in other people.
Women's groups also demonstrated against what they view as the Trump administration's attacks on reproductive rights.
There seems to be fewer people compared to the more than 100,000 who protested Trump on his visit here last year. Organizers say that it's because it's a weekday and blame the poor weather. Still, the commotion that they caused can be heard about a block away at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office where Trump and May had their joint press conference.
Trump dismissed the protests as fake news and said he felt only tremendous love from the British people.
Even coming over today, there were thousands of people cheering. And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests.
Aside from that issue, Trump told reporters he is committed to what he called a phenomenal bilateral trade deal.
There is tremendous potential in that trade deal. I say probably two and even three times of what we're doing right now.
Prime Minister Theresa May, who steps down as the Conservative Party leader Friday over failure to reach an agreement on Brexit, also expressed support for a bilateral trade deal.
And it is this relationship that helps to ensure there are jobs that employ people here in the UK and in the United States that underpins our prosperity and our future.
But analysts downplay the chances of reaching a trade deal anytime soon.
With Brexit still uncertain and the inability to determine what a future U.S.-UK trade relationship will look like without the resolution to the question of whether the U.K. will remain in the customs union or the single market with the European Union.
Further wading into the Brexit controversy, Trump met with pro-Brexit leader Nigel Farage, a strong critic of May. On Wednesday, Trump will continue his trip with D-Day commemoration ceremonies in both Britain and France and a stop in Ireland. Patsy Wuodukuswara, VOA News, London.
Well, as world leaders gather in France Wednesday for the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion that marks the beginning of the end of World War II, a museum in New Orleans, Louisiana, stands as a permanent memorial in tribute to all who served and sacrificed in the deadliest conflict in U.S. in human history. VOA's Keen Farabaugh reports on the little-known connection between the Crescent City and the D-Day invasion.
You were a fighter pilot?
No. B-24.
Champ Vinay.
I'll be 97 in a month.
Vividly remembers June 6th, 1944, D-Day.
We knew it was coming. We didn't know when, of course.
Vinay was training to become a bomber pilot when Allied forces landed on the beaches of Normandy in the largest military invasion in history. But the drumbeats of war came to New Orleans long before.
What World War II did for my area, the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, was create jobs. We're talking about coming out of a depression where unemployment was 15 to 20, and Higgins created a huge amount of jobs.
New Orleans businessman Andrew Higgins was part of the pre-war U.S. arsenal of democracy, supplying equipment to America's allies. When the U.S. entered the fight in 1941, his factories equipped the military with a vessel critically important to the D-Day invasion.
In the immortal words of Dwight Eisenhower, this was how we won the war. Without those Higgins boats, there was no way that we could put 156,000 troops onto the beaches of Normandy.
Keith Huxton is a senior director at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, located where many of the Higgins boats were built.
This was New Orleans' great contribution to that war effort.
A contribution repaid in 2000 when the National D-Day Museum opened to highlight the Crescent City's role in the war effort. But some veterans who visited felt the museum needed more.
We have to expand the story. You have to include all of the American experience in World War II, why it was fought, how it was won, what it means today.
The National D-Day Museum transformed into the National World War II Museum in 2004 and now occupies a campus that continues to grow in a $400 million expansion. Over 700,000 people visit each year.
I do not believe that our museum romanticizes World War II. We try to show the realities, and the realities are pain and death and suffering for large parts of the world.
Champ Vinay flew a number of missions in Europe during World War II as a bomber pilot. He is now part of a dwindling number from the Greatest Generation.
Do you know how much people like you bombed?
Yeah.
Passing along their stories.
The accuracy wasn't too well.
Which Vinay recently started doing as a museum volunteer. Vinay feels a sense of duty sharing stories of what he lived through.
It went almost 300 miles an hour.
And what was lost.
Well, maybe it'll help prevent it happening again. Of course, war has changed. It won't happen that way, but World War II, life was cheap. We lost people by the millions.
A message that resonates with visitors to this museum, which memorializes a war that General Dwight Eisenhower called a great and noble crusade. Cain Fairbaugh, VOA News, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Iran vows to keep its missile program and rejects the U.S. offer to negotiate. The White House tells two ex-aides to defy Democrat subpoenas. Kim Jong-un's sister reappears in public after a lengthy absence. And Russia heats up the race for the Arctic. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump said Tuesday that it is more likely than not he will impose a 5% tariff on imported products from Mexico next week.
We are going to see if we can do something, but I think it's more likely that the tariffs go on, and we'll probably be talking during the time that the tariffs are on and they're going to be paid.
Trump offered his assessment at a London news conference alongside British Prime Minister Theresa May, even as U.S. and Mexican officials in Washington Tuesday were in talks about the tariffs and the surge of Central American migrants traveling through Mexico to reach the U.S. Trump has threatened to increase the tariffs monthly in 5% increments if Mexico does not do more to stop the flow of migrants coming over the U.S. border. Or from Mexico. In the U.S., some Republicans, though, normally political allies of Trump, are opening discussions on whether to try to pass legislation to block his tariff plan, fearing the cost would be passed on to U.S. consumers. Joining us to talk more about it is Christopher Wilson, Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. Chris, what is your take on the threat of tariffs on Mexico over border security?
I think it's interesting that the president feels the need to threaten Mexico with a tariff when, in reality, Mexico is at the table working with the United States to manage this crisis. You know, is it true that Mexico could do more? Probably so. But is it true that Mexico isn't doing anything, as the president has tweeted? No, absolutely not. Mexico is actually, in recent weeks, deporting and detaining record numbers of Central American migrants and is obviously in Washington to negotiate and try to figure out what else they can do to work with the United States to manage this challenge.
When you say Mexico is deporting these people, clearly they're leaving for a reason.
Right. I think it's very important that both Mexico and the United States focus on improving their asylum systems as well as simply their border security. Mexico, just like the United States, has obligations that they've taken on under international agreement to provide safety to those who are fleeing their countries, whether they're facing torture or some other type of violence. Not every single migrant
immigrant who's moving from Central America through Mexico to the United States is making a claim that it's dangerous for them to be returned to their home country. So there are cases in which deportation may be an appropriate response, but it's very important that both countries invest and make sure that they have an asylum system that can quickly and fairly adjudicate claims when they do come up and not return those who would be under significant risk of violence should they be returned home.
It looks, though, like this administration is doing more to tighten the rules when it comes to immigration at all in the U.S., whether it's through asylum means or otherwise.
Right. I mean, clearly from the U.S. perspective, the U.S. government is focusing very much on short-term measures to deter people from migrating in the first place. That makes negotiations with Mexico very difficult because the Mexican administration has been very focused, at least in its public discussions and comments, on long-term solutions, thinking of development as the solution to migration. We've been talking much more about the protection of migrants. And so, you know, we really have two presidents, Andrés Manuel López Obrador on the Mexican side and Donald Trump on the U.S. side, who seem to be living in different universes in terms of the challenge. And so what the challenge is in terms of the negotiations is how do you bring those two sides together? It actually would be an ideal solution to marry the two together, have both short-term solutions and long-term solutions, to understand that you both need to deter migrants so that there aren't excessively large flows that are politically and operationally unsustainable while offering protection to those who most need it.
And the president says that this is a security issue. He wants a wall. Others are arguing this is not a security issue. These are not dangerous people, and that there need to be different solutions to addressing why this is happening. Is this a security issue?
First and foremost, it's a failure in our asylum system. Our asylum system is proving itself incapable to adjudicate fairly and quickly all the claims that are in front of it, all the people that come in front of it and say they're fearful of being returned to their home country. Because we don't have a system, an asylum system that can function, that is up to the task in front of it, we then have a situation in which our Border Patrol is totally overwhelmed by what's happening. Health and Human Services is overwhelmed in their capacity to handle the children in particular and family units that are crossing the border. That does raise security concerns because our Border Patrol, instead of focusing on important security issues, is focusing simply on migrant processing. So I don't disagree that there's a security element to it, but what we need to understand is that the solution does not lie in adding layers of border security. A wall would do nothing to solve this problem. Simply having additional agents at the border would do very little to solve this problem. What we really need are more immigration judges and a better system to quickly adjudicate asylum claims so that those who are, you know, by law allowed to stay in the United States are able to do so, and those who are by law not allowed to stay in the United States are quickly returned to their home country.
There are concerns that the tariffs could actually hurt the U.S. economy.
No doubt that tariffs would hurt the U.S. economy. The tariffs would be borne by U.S. consumers and U.S. manufacturers, because we import so many parts and materials from Mexico to fuel our factories in the United States, and of course consumers, because when they buy a finished good, whether it's an avocado and tomato or some sort of finished product from Mexico, they would be the ones paying the tariff. So there's no doubt it would be bad for the U.S. economy. And the question as to whether or not this could possibly lead to a solution, I mean, I think we have to absolutely just be honest and say that there is a political dimension to all of this. The president is about to kick off his campaign again for reelection. Having a conflict and a confrontation and a crisis around this issue may in some ways be in the interest politically of the president. So I think we have to be honest about that. But that said, I also absolutely believe that there are officials on both sides of the border who are sitting down and negotiating right now, looking for real on-the-ground solutions. And hopefully they can reach some agreements that will be reasonable, that will have an impact on the ground. Hopefully they can agree to go after smuggling criminal organizations, in some cases taking advantage of and putting at risk migrants. Hopefully they can agree on ways to better share intelligence across the border. So there are real things that could happen, and I hope that we can get to those. But the politics of the situation and the sort of the distance between the viewpoints of the two presidents on both sides of the border make that very difficult right now.
All right, that's Christopher Wilson, Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. The U.S. Treasury Department has tightened restrictions on travel to Cuba in retaliation to the country's destabilizing role in the Western Hemisphere region. The agency said in a statement Tuesday it's banned group educational people-to-people travel to Cuba, one of the primary ways Americans can visit the Caribbean island. Thousands of Americans began using this method to visit even before the administration of former even before the administration of former President Barack Obama restored full diplomatic relations with the country in 2014. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the ban was imposed for Cuba's role in the region, including its support for Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Joining us to talk more about the impacts of the new policies is Eric Lorber, Senior Director for the Center for Economic and Financial Power at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. So can you first explain to us exactly what these changes the U.S. government has made?
I think what the Treasury Department has done, along with the Commerce Department, is essentially they've made it even more difficult for U.S. persons to go to Cuba, particularly for what they call person-to-person travel. Essentially, what that looks like is it was historically used by many individuals to go to Cuba for vacation-like purposes. So even though tourism, even though U.S. persons really can't go to Cuba for tourism, they're prohibited from doing so. You saw over the last 2 years a significant number of U.S. citizens traveling to the island and sort of enjoying a mojito on the beach in Havana. And the Trump administration is continuing to try to prevent this from happening.
The travel issue. It was actually authorized under the Obama administration, and as you mentioned, many people took advantage of that. What does this mean for people who want to go to Cuba, American citizens? Can they still somehow find a way to go, or would they be stopped if they tried?
There are actually 12 specific ways that U.S. persons can go to Cuba right now, and this closes off really only one of those 12. So there are still a number of ways that if you're a U.S. person, you can go to Cuba, for example, as part of organized educational programs, in some situations as part of humanitarian missions. So there really are ways to do it. What the administration is really trying to close off here is they're trying to close off this exception that allowed for people to go to Cuba under the, you know, auspices of quote-unquote people-to-people contact when those individuals were really just going to hang out on the beach or going to hang out, you know, drinking mojitos wherever in Havana. So it's only one specific reason that people are no longer allowed to go to Cuba. But it is a big one,
okay.
In large part because the Cuban regime has benefited significantly from tourism-related money
right.
that's come in over the last few years.
Right, and apparently the administration also made another change with regarding export control of private and corporate aircraft and recreational vessels, which would also impact the hospitality industry there?
Exactly. Essentially, if there is a U.S. origin product, like a cruise ship that's built in the United States,
mm-hmm.
the U.S. can regulate what that ship can be used for. And as part of the announcement, the Commerce Department came out and said, we will no longer allow U.S. origin vessels, for example, to go to Cuba or to dock in Cuba. So all of a sudden, cruise ships, for example, which may be U.S. origin, will no longer enjoy the authorization to go to Cuba and to bring tourists to Cuba. What's interesting here is that not only will it impact the Cuban tourism industry, but it's also going to impact countries outside of both Cuba and the United States. Because let's say that you're a European tour company operating a boat that was built in the United States, a cruise ship. You are no longer going to be able to sail that cruise ship into Havana or into a Cuban port to bring tourists, even though you may not have any U.S. citizens on that boat. So it makes it more difficult for European companies in particular to allow the tourism industry to continue to grow in Cuba.
Would putting more pain on Cuba's economy also impact our own economy? Does it benefit us when Cuba does well? How does all of that work as far as what we do to them and how it impacts us and the rest of the world?
I do think that this will have an economic impact on the United States. There are a number of U.S. tourism companies or U.S. companies that are providing for services for U.S. persons to go to Cuba. That is going to stop, and so that will cause an impact on, I won't call it the tourism industry, but on the industry that has facilitated travel to Cuba, and that includes cruise ships, airlines that have been flying to Cuba, and it includes the hospitality industry that's been operating in Cuba, including with U.S. partners. So, for example, U.S. hotel chains that may have been operating there may have more difficulty continuing. Likewise, it's also going to impact European companies, European tourism companies that have been operating there. So this is going to cause U.S. companies some economic pain. It may not be as large as the pain it will cause Cuba. This administration has been very focused in the last few months on raising the economic pressure on Cuba, primarily in response to the Cuban regime's support of Venezuela and Nicaragua. But this definitely will be an economically painful move to certain industries within the United States.
All right, that's Eric Lorber, Senior Director for the Center for Economic and Financial Power at the Foundation for the defense of democracies. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The International Basketball Federation, known as FIBA, is expecting the Professional African League due to launch in 2020 to be a showcase and breeding ground for new talent. With the support of Africa-born former NBA stars Dikembe Mutombo, young talents are already getting support to move up to the next level. Elizabeth Casimiro reports for VOA from Luanda.
Former NBA star and Hall of Famer Dikembe Mutombo has helped set up an NBA-supported clinic to train and observe new talent in Luanda, the capital of Angola, where he made a visit last week.
It's all about tomorrow.
Dikembe is following his roots as he was born and grew up in Kinshasa, a 45-minute flight from here before he became an NBA All-Star.
I think my presence means a lot to show to the young people who are playing the game here that we still care about them, we're following them, we want them to succeed. And we want the game of basketball to continue to grow in the continent.
The clinic has been organized by Will Voigt, an American basketball coach who is currently the head coach of the Angola national basketball team. After training Nigeria, he is now helping Angola to build the next generation of players.
So we're trying as best we can to give them a fair opportunity to learn, to grow. And we've already seen, you know, what players from the continent can do when given that.
Olumide Oyedeji, one of the former NBA players who came with Dikembe, believes that African basketball is growing and that it has overcome the times when the game was dominated by a few countries like Angola and Egypt. He hopes one day an African national team may reach the FIBA World Top 10.
I believe we have a chance. We have to just continue, keep playing, keep getting better. They said the journey of a thousand might start with a step. I believe we're taking the right step.
As the search for new talent takes place, Angola hosted the final of the FIBA Africa Basketball League 2019. Local home team Primeiro de Agosto won the competition, beating Association Sportive de Salé 83-71 to get a record 9th African title.
The concept of this is Africa. It's not a national. It's Africa at all. This is why we give opportunity for the teams to have a part of foreign players, to have two African teams, two African players.
The new league, to be known as the Basketball Africa League, or BAL, is scheduled to play in January, with 12 teams from across Africa. The teams will be chosen through regional competitions, and the top teams will advance to the BAL. For VOA News, Elizabeth Casimiro from Luanda.
You have my heart, and we'll never be worlds apart. Maybe in
Forbes has added Rihanna to its list of the world's richest self-made women, but what's really astounding about it is that the singer, with a net worth of $600 million, is also now the world's richest female musician, according to Forbes. Born in Barbados as Robin Rihanna Fenty, she is regarded as an influential pop icon, but her music and acting are not the only way she has created wealth. Rihanna is also quite the entrepreneur and businesswoman. She has a hugely successful makeup brand and a luxury fashion line. Again, Forbes now saying that singer Rihanna is the world's richest female musician.
You've been
listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting greater respect for human rights remains a key component of U.S. foreign policy, including in its relations with Vietnam. At a recent meeting of the U.S.-Vietnam Human Rights Dialogue, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Busby expressed concern over the increasing number of political prisoners in Vietnam, which he estimated to be over 100. Mr. Busby described his visit with one such prisoner.
While I was in Vietnam, I made a visit to one political prisoner of particular concern, namely Chun Thi Nha, who is imprisoned in the middle of the country. She received a 9-year-long sentence merely for exercising her freedom of speech. She served 2 years of that sentence already, but faces another 7 years.
Internet freedom is also under assault in Vietnam, reports Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby. Vietnam, he said, recently adopted a cybersecurity law that we have a number of concerns about. We, as the Human Rights Bureau, of course, are concerned about the restrictions this law poses on exercise of freedom of speech. Bloggers are being arrested in ever larger numbers. The U.S. raised with Vietnam the case of blogger and contributor to Radio Free Asia, Chung Zui Nhat, said Mr. Busby.
He was recently in Thailand, applied for refugee status in Thailand with UNHCR, and then mysteriously disappeared from Thailand and suddenly reappeared in a jail in Vietnam. We're very concerned about his case, about the circumstances surrounding his abduction in Thailand and his transfer to Vietnam. He has not yet been charged or prosecuted, but we're very concerned about the way the government is treating his case.
With regard to religious freedom, the Vietnamese government's record is mixed, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby.
We continue to have concern that unregistered religious groups in Vietnam are being harassed, are not able to freely practice their religion. That said, those groups that have been willing to register under Vietnam's religious freedom law have enjoyed a greater degree of freedom to practice their religions than they have in the past.
The U.S. continues to call on the Vietnamese government to release all prisoners of conscience and allow all Vietnamese citizens to express their political views without fear of retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is